You should just tell me one thing before we start. Is there anything that you've been working on lately or thinking about lately that would be really helpful for me to know about before doing the interview?
Yes, my first release of a home cassette.
Oh, great.
Because I was the first who ever did a home box office show.
I know, and I don't have HBO. Haverford. It's really awful.
I've done four now.
I know, yeah.
I'm recording a new album, which wouldn't be released till 4 or 5 months later. I haven't had one in a long time. Writing activities, possibly. No, I was just thinking. Do you ever take? You don't take any breaks, right? You never say there's a break and you put on a public service now.
No. There's no commercials. No, it's so this will just be seamless. Okay, you want to start?
Sure.
Your first album was called Child of the 50s, and in it you referred a lot to growing up in the 50s. What do you think of the 50s nostalgia craze that we still seem to be in the middle of?
No comment. You thought I was going to be an easy interview, huh? You're allowed to laugh, you know. say it again. I mean, what do I think of the 50s?
What do you think of the 50s nostalgia craze? People seem to just be, like, really affectionate about those times, how terrific they were. Some would even say sanitizing them.
I was so intent on a joke, saying no comment with your first question, that I didn't even hear the question. I was talking about the 50s in nostalgic terms when I was already in college. I went to Alfred University when I was 16 years old in 1958. By 1959 and 60, I was singing the old songs from 55. In the 60s, I mean, I was almost, my album, which was made in 1973, was really an anti-nostalgia album. It's written all over it. I have a very authentic 50s doo-wop rock song, which I did all the voices, A Lifelong Dream, juxtaposed against very cynical lyrics about McCarthyism, the Korean War. And I didn't really think much of them as much of it as a decade, although I'm beginning to change, right? That's sort of a silly... there are substantial things that happen in any decade, but now it's archaic. It's positively a museum piece and seemingly endlessly inspirational to people. So, I mean, just 50s has become a cliche. I knew my album would be called 50s Child or Child of the 50s, and I knew it for a long time. Some of that music I can listen to and enjoy still, but very, very little of it wasn't skillfully done. And
for some strange reason, people like to sum up the world in terms of decades. Do the 80s strike you as being particularly anything? Is there a way you'd sum up what the 80s look like so far to you?
Well, there is a sort of insensitive trend, perhaps. It's hard to say it's only 80s. It may have been happening for a while now. Maybe Vietnam, the experience of Vietnam, the country eating some crow and... our inability to be omnipotent any longer in the world. There's much said and written about the possible end in sight of the American dream. Indeed, a lot of people feel it's ending for them. A lot of people are going to college, but they're studying accounting and things that they think will earn them a good living when they get out, and they have every right to think that. People ask me, because I travel to a lot of colleges, how I think they've changed over the decades and all that. And I think their nose are to the grindstone, but there's so little in the way of electives. People don't speak languages. They're not reading. They're laughing at some and enjoying, it seems to me, a lot of pap, more than usual, perhaps. I don't know. That's the only thing I can say. I really have not seen the decades so individually. It's been a continuum for a while. I'm so busy in my life, really. It's.
You're Jewish, and I know you grew up in New York City in the Bronx. Did you ever get taken to the Catskills or go on your own? And if so, I'd really love to know what you thought of all the Borscht Belt comics of I guess, the 50s and 60s, if you were familiar with them.
Well, my home was, my mother was a medical stenographer at Montefiore Hospital. My father sold textiles as a salesman. My sister's a teacher. In our home, show business was very prominent. My parents never missed Broadway shows since the 20s. The movies, my mother knew who was married to who and so forth. And we loved comedians. My father was a very, very funny person. Tremendous timing and all. I think probably a frustrated comedian. I always paid attention to the comedians on television. And in the opportunities that I had working in the so-called Borscht Belt as a lifeguard, a day camp counselor, a busboy. I would pretty much pay attention to those small-time Saturday night shows when they'd have a roller skating team open and have some poor singer who works in the A&P during the week, Italian boy from Philadelphia who panders with Jewish songs, and black acts that sing my Yiddish and mama and use the word schwarze. And, the comedians were always intriguing to me. I tell you, you know, two bald-headed men, you put your heads together, you make an ass of yourself, you know, that sort of thing. I think it is a remarkable art that is in one stand-up comedian. It's peculiarly American. It's probably basically a post-war phenomenon. There's very little written about it. Last Laugh by Phil Berger. Steve Allen attempted to write something about it. It's more than just music hall with a song and all that. It's a guy standing there for a while, you know.
Was there a kind of comedian you were determined to not become?
Yes, I never saw Lenny Bruce in person, but I saw clips and heard the albums. And I was so impressed when he was at Carnegie Hall and that he concertized, if that is a word. The thing I didn't like about the image of stand-up comedian is a smoke-filled room with dance, kid, you know, with people getting drunk and yelling out and all that. Even though I'm appearing in the Atlantis Hotel this weekend in Atlantic City, where the wages are good and the living is easy. It's so orderly and all that. But to be quite honest, my favorite context venue is not one in which people are drinking and eating. Of course, they've finished their dinner, but and they don't serve while I'm on, but tables, you know. I really prefer a theater situation. When I'm on Broadway or I'm in a play, well, people face the stage. And most of the performances I do are in that context. There's very few clubs, as you'd say, although cabaret has a great history. Second City, which we'll talk about later, was the essence of great cabaret, where people were served drinks and all that. I felt it's more important. I felt, you asked me what comedian I didn't want to be. What I didn't want to be was just a guy who did fat girlfriend jokes and this and that. Like, Henny Youngman is wonderful. He's wonderful. But I didn't want to be like Henny Youngman. I wanted to say things. I wanted to be conceptual, subtle, and yet I love silliness too, intelligent, bring my education to bear, bring the language to bear, which I think very few comedians do.
When you started performing, I think you were performing in New York initially in folk clubs. Did the folk audience have an interest in comedians, or were the comedians seen as just the frivolous stuff till you got to the real, you know, political and folk music?
When I began trying out, I was a substitute teacher. I was out of Yale Graduate School for Drama, feeling really low in the fall of 63. No real prospects. I left graduate school after a year. I'm out of school for the first time in my life. My father has reminded me, too, that he spent a lot of money for an education. What do I know? History, political science major, graduate school in drama. I started substitute teaching. And while I was substitute teaching, I had the courage, it took a lot of guts, some months later, to go down to what they called Hoot Nanny Night in Greenwich Village, Cafe Wah, the Bitter End. And night a week, when the regular performer wasn't performing, they were dark, they would have a kind of tryout night, which they called Hoot Nanny. The very name itself implies music. As a matter of fact, when I went down there, there were 10 singers to every one comedian. There was a lot of people tuning, and I like, Michael, row, ka-plunk, your boat, ka-plunk, ashore, ka-plunk. And, you know, a lot of coffee being ordered, and berets, and that sort of thing. And I did well a few nights. And then I began doing poorly. And I didn't know why, because I didn't have the expertise. No. Second City busted everything out. But at that time, the trails were not as well blazed. Woody Allen and Bill Cosby and a number had gone before me, but there wasn't the well-worn grooves and channels and arteries and capillaries that exist now in this business of stand-up comedy.
What did you learn from Second City that you think you might not have ever figured out on your own?
Well, it was basically, I had the raw talent. That's how I got the job. Fred Willard and I were strangers. We auditioned and did an improv together at William Morris Agency in front of 50 people who were auditioning and who made suggestions and whatever, and we got the job. in 65. Well, first of all, I learned a true method for improvisation. Before, I would rely on my rough, my crazy and very quick head going and developing things. And Paul Sills, the original director at Second City, whose mother wrote the book called Improvisation for the Theater. Her name is Viola Spolin. Very simply, it's this. I'm facing you across a table. Our radio listeners can't see that. But if I were to do an improvisation with you, the worst thing an improviser can do is what he calls playwright. That is, I have a brother back in Tennessee and blah, blah, blah. My brother in Tennessee isn't relevant here. You are. The color of your reddish hair, your tweed jacket, the way your hands are clasped under your chin could be the key to the scene because it's now. I'm looking at you, I'm listening to you, and vice versa. And if you have to, make a ball, take it from a shelf, mime it. Maybe the scene will be in that ball. But the immediacy of improvisation is the key. And that's exactly how I write all my material, except more and more I'm pre-writing. I think of an idea, write it down, and develop it, decide to try it that night. But most of the stuff has been kind of exploded out of me, like a jazz musician, a thing that inspires that. It's almost another person doing it. It happens. And it's recorded either on a tape or my pianist or I remember at the end and develop it. And so Second City gave me that discipline that when I tried stand up next at the improvisation, when I was finished with 14 months at Second City in Chicago and a little run in New York, I got into a Broadway show called Apple Tree, which Mike Nichols directed. And after the show was over, I'd walk down this 44th Street to the Improvisation Club with a tape recorder and start getting up there. And from the start, I was very good at it and kept developing material. It gave me an overall method, a discipline for creating comedy and comedy ideas and the invaluable toning and sharpening of my performance skills under excellent directors. Every night I had to perform set sketches and then improvise in a session immediately after that.
What would you do if you would flop when you were on stage? On those nights when you didn't get the response that you wanted?
Well, of course, in the very beginning, it takes almost as much guts to do this as it appears.
As it does to substitute teach, probably, too, right?
Well, that's right. not really. You don't have much responsibility there, but yes, it could be aggravating. Actors, for example, are in absolute awe of a stand-up comedian, how you can do that. At the beginning, there were those times, and the flop sweat starts coming out. I'm so convinced now of, I mean, I don't even think about failure. People pay to see me, and they're sitting there, and it's always going to be devastating. I do have special jobs for fundraisers or other kind of contexts, like where people paid $10,000 a plate in Palm Beach for an organization, and I'm standing there, where it isn't the easiest thing in the world. Those people did not actually go out of their way and pay for a ticket to see me, and there are special things that I must bring to bear and techniques. Going back to your question, it is pretty horrendous to stand there and bomb. And I was so determined that I didn't want to have that feeling that I made certain pretty early on that I would keep on my toes. Number one, I've written so much material, so if something isn't working, pull right out of it into something else that the audience wouldn't even know. Number two, I always improvise things, think of new things. They happen to me, the room, the environment. Number three, I have a performance poise and a technique developed over the years so that I don't bail out after the... You watch a kid on The Tonight Show, first two jokes don't work, and that's hard because it's only 6 minutes. You don't have over an hour to spend with these folks. And right away you can see, if you look very carefully, it just he begins apologizing for the rest of the material. So the only way you can combat that is with technique. And it just is, as awful as it seems, it is a ridiculous kind of situation to be in.
In the late 60s and early 70s, everyone of the baby boom generation, I think, wanted to be like a bohemian or an activist of some sort or something. And it was considered very unhip to be middle class, to be a Jewish middle class person from New York. You know, you were from the Bronx. Did you ever play that up and make it seem like you were really, really tough because you were from the Bronx and you knew knife play and I knew people who used to do that. We used to really play up being from Brooklyn or the Bronx and try to create this whole persona from it that they didn't really have, but they knew they could get away with.
Well, of course, only for a real dullard. A real dullard would take me for someone who's brought up tough. You know, my parents, watch out for that lamb cord. You're going out at night, wear white colors. You know, my parents wait an hour after you eat before you go in swimming. You will die like that boy on Hull Avenue did, you know. My parents had a different approach to child rearing than, say, the Flying Willenders. I would hardly could do the toughness angle. But, you see, I was very, very... I wanted to combine... You're quite right about that, people wanting to be bohemian, or how at least my friends and I were so above it all. We were rather snobbish. Thought everyone was the squarest thing in life. We called them blanderts. The rest of the world was all bland, and we were the funny ones. We giggled. I think there was a kind of rebellion against the Jewish heritage a little. In my house, I didn't get a very strict Jewish upbringing at all, but the consciousness of being Jewish, it's obviously a very integral part of our upbringing. I was brought up in a neighborhood where there were not only Jews, but certainly there were a lot of them. And these are people, my parents were born in New York. They're the first generation, though, from Hungary. And one set that came in 1882 and another set in 1899. It was very important to me when I went into show business not to change my name. Extremely important. Robert Kay, Robert Kellogg, Robert, you know. I didn't want to. That was very important. And also, I did some foolish things, actually, in order to make show business fit into my politico-intellectual spirit. That is, that I was, I wouldn't say radical politically, but I close to it. I mean, I was involved and cared. I felt that there's so much of a doting on mediocrity, which is probably still true. People deal the word genius around every 2 seconds. It can make you throw up. And no, it's Bach in Handel's 300th birthday, and I haven't heard that too much. I haven't seen too many birthday cakes on the campuses. And in addition to that, for example, with the name, I didn't do things like take special care about my hair. Right now, I need a haircut desperately as I face you. Luckily, this is radio. I'm also naked, one of the other advantages of radio. People don't actually know that. Care about my eyebrow going straight across because that's pretense and all that. Hairs growing out of my nose, which I didn't notice. Not getting the space between my teeth fixed properly. So here I am, a romantic lead, kissing beautiful Joan Hackett, the late actress, in a film I did with her, a kind of offbeat film in New York called Rivals. And sometimes I look at myself, I said, how could you have done that? How could you have grown those mutton chops? They're wrong. You know? Also, I declined anything spectacular. I declined lots of series, lots of big series, because I thought they were corny and I wouldn't watch them. And I feel very softly about all that. Now, really, I want a tremendous diversity in American television and other forms of entertainment because that's what America's about. It brings people happiness, great. But it's not that everything I've done has gotten the seal of approval. But, basically those kinds of feelings of trying to bring show business to terms that are livable with me. By the way, it's a fine business. It's no more evil than anyone else's.
Well, when you started performing, I think you were performing to an audience that in part defined itself as being countercultural, being like outside of the mainstream and different from what you were going to tune in on television that night. But do you think that audience has changed as they've gotten older and as they've become more assimilated into the mainstream or more defined what the mainstream is?
I think the audience has changed, and I have too. I've floated right along. It's a very good point, countercultural. The first approach was when I did, for example, Las Vegas with Barbara Streisand. I had a terrible experience, especially New Year's Eve when people yelled out drunk and all that. Barbara was great. I mean, I had no problem with her, but, hey, North Carolina, you know, $35 a ticket in 1972. And I said to myself, I never wanted to do this cufflink stuff, you know. Colleges, man, and then I made three albums in a row, 73, 74, 75, and I performed in a lot of college gyms, and I let my hair grow, and the long hair was fine. I should have groomed it better. It was always clean, but it was, you know, it was kind of a little, didn't favor me the way it should have. And what I like now is that as my work gets better and better, it becomes also more and more truthful. I don't have to pretend to be anybody. And the actual thing that I dreamt of is only a possibility many years ago is true now. That is that I can go to Utah, to University of Utah, and there's a Robert Klein performance and people come and I am the Bronx Jew who I am. It's so unfair, actually. It's almost like I'm trying to shock the Bronx Jew. It's not only what I am, but I am a New York, urban, educated, certainly Jewish man. I don't have to change my speech. I don't have to change much. A question often asked me, do you do the same show in Atlantic City that you do at Harvard? Or, well, not really exactly, but I have so many hours of material to choose from. Who knows where my improvisations will take me on a given night? I have tremendous freedom. But the real thing is that I am consistent. I have a real identity. I'm a person. And they understand universalities from Alaska to Utah to Texas to Maine to the Bronx. I don't know anything about Wales or Christmases in it, but in Child's Christmas in Wales, Dylan Thomas, after a short while you're reading it, he gives you the proper information you need, and then what they really are is people and feelings and ideas. And we are, after all earthlings, and you'd be surprised when something is universal, people get with it. They identify with it themselves, even though we're from opposite ends of the universe.
You know how we were talking before about how people used to...
We haven't been talking. I haven't stopped, and you're incredible the way you just allow the guests to go. Interrupt any time, please.
Okay. You know how we were talking a couple of minutes ago about how everybody used to want to be bohemian, and it was almost embarrassing to be middle class. You think everybody now wants to be upper class?
No, I think what now exists, there'll always be people for whom dress, clothing is superfluous. I think, frankly, everyone tells me how great I look when I dress up, which is, and sometimes I really enjoy wearing a tie and going somewhere, but I still have to count it down there on the list of really crucial things about a person. No, you still have a counterculture there. It seems rather mindless. And I think maybe, am I getting to be a crotchety old guy because I'm 43? But it's pink hair, and it's outfit taken from here and there, and you know. I mean, you asked, do we all want to become upper class? I think everyone wants to get ahead as much as possible. It is a money-oriented and success-oriented society, and don't let anyone kid you. It can't buy ultimately happiness, but boy, is it important.
My guest is Robert Klein, if you're just joining us, and I want to mention that he'll be performing this weekend at Atlantic City. Can I ask you how you originated that eerie, scary, ooey sound that you do?
It stems from, I think my parents, as a father myself, I'd like to raise my child, and maybe I hope we have another one, to be a little more intrepid, at least in childhood. Everyone is scared of certain things. And I think I just took a movie cliche. Probably somebody once wrote me a long letter, which was the first movie ever to use it. But I'm imitating an electronic instrument called a theremin. Right? And so I just began to write bits, which I haven't done in a long time. I think they're from on my last album, New Teeth. About what I call the scary woo-woo. I think it was a combination of something, childhood fears, and then take that scary noise and then put it on adult fears. And, when I made the observation that people are so crazy about animals, I mean crazy about animals, look at the absolute unspeakable catastrophes happening to children throughout the world through starvation, through violence, murder. Some people try to torture a couple of kids in Brooklyn the other day and some dope murder and all this. And yet, if someone throws a dart into a cage at the San Diego Zoo, it makes front page and people go, what is this world coming to? You know, and all that. I said, people loading other people into concentration camps going, I steigen die Juden! Oh, a puppy. Hans, look, we take it, you know. And then I would go, my comment on that remark. That's how I guess I've been using it. I haven't done it as much lately.
I bet, though, that you hear a lot of people walking around doing it.
Yes, I have never, again, going against convention, I would have been smart to perhaps have some sort of hook, like Rodney Dangerfield has No Respect, that wonderful thing which he, believe me, worked very hard on for the years and that he worked. I mean, for a while people thought it was saddle shoes because I wore them a lot. Other people think it's woo-woo, you know. A lot of people say, I can't stop my leg on the street. I would imagine that more people around the country and the North American continent have stopped me or said, woo, some bad imitations of Thurman's than any other single hook, but I never intended it to be that way.
You're a father now, right? Has the perspective of your humor, the point of view, changed from the point of view of I remember when I was a child to now that I'm a parent? You know, have you changed from like child jokes to parent jokes?
My wife's pregnancy and the subsequent birth of our child, and he's now 15 months old, currently in Nice, France, where my wife is singing a Mozart. You never can tell a plug. Maybe someone will be in. I would say that I've extracted a good deal of material. I really have. But I think more that I have this feeling you describe of becoming more of a parent. For example, in MTV, when I see it, and I see which are skillful and which are really pandering to these cheap instincts, some really bad music done by some bad musicians and singers with vulgar, right? I mean, women are being trashed like never before on MTV, just for example. Men are too, in a way, but it's as if nothing ever happened in the last 15 or 20 years in the realization of the unique problems of women as a gender and class and all that. I'm trying not to say women's lib, but you know what I mean. It's as if nothing went down when you look at that sometimes. And I guess I think as a parent, gee, I'd be worried if my kid went to this concert and they all have their hands in the air like Hitler, you know, going. And then I begin to feel like a parent and like Alan King on the Ed Sullivan Show 35 right. years ago, and I want to slash my wrist and start over. I don't want to get like that. I like some good rock and roll.
What I really want to know is, have you taught your son words like poo-poo and tutu and all those words that you've talked about?
Well, one of the things I talk about in material is to, first of all, to give my parents credit. My father died not too long ago. My mother is an incredibly spunky 76-year-old woman, plays a great stride piano and all that. I think they tried very hard. I think they made several mistakes, particularly my father was too harsh in certain areas or perhaps insensitive in others, but he tried. I think it's just plain intelligence to learn from what you perceive as the mistakes of your parents. Like my friend Al Uger, who's a writer-producer, who's my best friend in California, he has two sons. He said, what I try to think, what would I have wanted my father to do in this situation? As far as tutu, pupu, and embarrassment and all that, using euphemisms for things like that, I think the times have taken care of that pretty much. So that there's nothing, I mean, we're not going to have a 1940s attitude about parts of the body. And yet certain things don't change. Certain kinds of conventions, certain feelings between parent and child. I already know, looking at my very advanced 15-month-old, but he's still dumb, and I know more. And I can see this 10 years from now. I'm going to know a lot more about a certain issue or thing, but this kid is becoming a human now. No more bawling little ball, you know. Actually, he didn't bawl that much. You suddenly realize this is more than a flower. It's more than a cocker spaniel. This is a whole human, a whole gizmo. And he has to have his freedom and say so. I can see already quite clearly the helplessness and pain that a parent can experience because of a child's intransigence or getting in trouble. Even though they are obviously partly to blame in every event, it's very hard not to feel sorry for some ghetto mother when her son is being sentenced to 25 years for murder and despised, and you know, or boy is in trouble, or whatever ethnic group, you know. But so already some of that, wait till you have children and all that, is quite clearly, that is the case. There's a lot of drama in parenthood.
My guest is Robert Klein, if you're just joining us, and he's performing in Atlantic City this weekend. Are there places in New York you go to hang out, just to watch crazy people behave in the hopes of maybe finding something you'd want to use in some material for something that you're writing?
I can't say that I ever actually go out specifically to do that, no. As a matter of fact, I don't really keep up very, I'm not very current on the new comedians. And since I don't need a place like the Improvisation anymore to practice, to try out stuff, I work so much that trying out new things is all part of the process. I find that show business is so overwhelming. What I do and the demands made on me and the offers that come my way and so are so complicated that my life, I really like to get away from it when I can. I think it's very consuming. I think we did not have the child for this reason, but my wife has an opera career too. I can tell you that it's going to be a wonderful balance. Because quite clearly, when she brought the child to France a few weeks ago and he had a terrible stomach virus and could not hold food and doctor can't speak English, and this is a place where my wife had throat troubles and they treated her with suppositories, and I'm not joking. I said, did you make it clear what the melody was? The whole different brand of medicine. You get worried, and the baby turned around and was fine. But I really don't have to go to a place to see funny people. They are situations are all around me every moment. And if you turn on the radio or watch television, they're there too. It's just, you read the newspaper, it's there. My particular talent is taking what everyone else sees and making it into coherent comedy. Other people's talent is to take what they see and draw it. But that's my talent. And I really have never felt the need to, I'm going to go out and get inspired or something. I've always been a people watcher. I'm an observer. But I think since I'm better known every year all the time, I think that has changed my life, too, a lot.
Was it hard to go out and observe people without being more observed yourself?
I am observed. And it's interesting, even though I'm an exhibitionist as a professional, I get up in front of hundreds and thousands of people and millions on television. It is very discomforting to be stared at sometimes in a restaurant or something. I can't quite get to it. And, of course, I know the various degrees of coolness people have in their technique. And most people are quite gracious, believe me. Any performer would admit that being recognized or someone telling you they like your work, as several people in the hall did here, that's very gratifying. But my life is changed that way, especially in the city I love very much. I like to spend a lot of time away from it. I have a country house about an hour north. I've always lived in the city, you know, basically. And I think that has changed it, too, a little bit. I just can't hang around and look without being observed myself. And
do people come up to you when you're in a restaurant or something and try to show off how funny they are?
Yes, it's one of the standard kind of immature things. Someone, let me tell you a joke. That's one that amazes me. And always people say, you can use this in your routine, and which is I smile at it because it's meant gracefully, but it really is denigrating in the sense I think it's just so uncomplicated as that. Oh, if someone will tell me a good story, I'll use it. Well, there's some other comedians who do that, but not Robert Klein, you know. Here's something that happened. I must tell you this. I get a lot of that. At a college level again, hey, George Carlin, hey, Steve Martin. But don't you think Steve Martin and George Carlin told me people say, hey, Robert Klein, or something? They're trying to show their affection by being irreverent, by being impertinent, really. Some cretinous ones like, hey, you're feeling, Julian Lennon, well, I wouldn't call it cretinous, but a young man didn't know quite what to say at Night of 100 Stars. He said, you're partially funny some of the time. Said, that's a nice thing to say, Julian. I'm twice your age. You know. Some people don't know how to be graceful. I remember I wanted very much at an awards dinner 8 years ago to tell Francis Coppola how much I enjoyed his work. And I wound up, I didn't say anything nasty, but my tongue got caught in a funny way. I didn't say what I exactly wanted to say. I myself do not that often go up to people who I don't know. It's rather unavoidable in Night of a Million Hours with hundreds of stars under the same roof and people talk to one another. But I guess I really would like to more. Groucho Marx wrote me lovely letters before he died, quite obviously before he died, but near the end of his life, I mean. And I don't know, people have sent me letters and it took me a long time to respond. I myself have sent a few. I felt very badly when they weren't returned. And yet I have done the same thing because I can't handle the correspondence and I'm not well organized.
Yeah, it's funny how that works. You know, you feel bad when you don't get written back, but who has the time to write, on the other hand?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever gotten to the point where you've started to, like, codify laughter? Do you have names that you have for different kinds of laughers or for different kinds of laughs?
What an interesting concept. There's the Hamburg.
It seems to me the vaudevillians really had that. You know, there's the Bafo, and there's... I've heard old vaudevillians talk that
way. I know all of them. I've never named them. I've never named them. I know what it's like. I know what the composition... For example, this studio would not be best because the walls don't ring. The sound is absorbed intentionally. You like something with a little more wood on the sides. Not so much carpeting, that sort of thing. I go for those biggies. I like compliments that are normally peculiarly negative seemingly negative in result. For example, my cheeks hurt. I love that one. Oh, I tell you, my back is out of alignment from the laughter. I mean, someone pays the money and goes in, and for an hour and 40 minutes, they're just hysterical laughing and shaking their head. Yes, I know that. Yes, that's a beautiful thing. I tend to take it for granted sometime. I remember when I was in Broadway last and they're playing our song and we got our applause. Lucy Arnaz, my co-star, I saw her eyes would glow, and the cast, who had very small parts, the chorus kind of, eyes would absolutely light up and they were in their glory. Well, I get that all the time and I'm the only one on the stage. I almost take it for granted, but yet the mission... I sometimes kid around as if I were an agent of humor, you know, another mission of mirth, a mission of humor. The mission is a beautiful one in the most practical way, watching all these people laugh. I've also gotten many touching letters over the years. My brother died of brain cancer. His only interest in his, you know, somebody I went to school with when I was in fourth grade, and his only interest in the last 5 months of his life was you and listening to your records. And I don't know if I'm a Norman Cousins.
Yeah, you might have helped him survive.
Right. I never read that he mentioned me, but I understand that. W.C. Fields films can very often lift me from a mild depression. And of course, there's the compactness of it. It's I take my sense of humor and a harmonica and I show up, and it's become very lucrative, too. And I don't mind that at all because a lot of people pay a reasonably small amount, and the enjoyment is worth it. It's live theater.
As a comedian, you've both hosted and guested on The Carson Show and The Tonight Show lots of times. Did it take you a while to work up the proper couch behavior and everything when you're on The Tonight Show?
Yes. There is a definite technique. Rodney Dangerfield was very helpful to me early in my career when he was already becoming a little established. But, you know, when I first met him at the Improvisation Club in the fall of 66, I didn't do The Tonight Show till January of 68. It'll be my, is that 15th year? 17th year that I'm doing it. It is not what it appears to be. You are not, talk shows were invented in order to present personalities, presumably celebrities, in a context in which you normally wouldn't see them. Esther Williams, instead of swimming, she sits on The Tonight Show. You know what I mean? That sort of thing. Well, you're not in someone's living room. You're in a television studio in front of millions of people with what really amounts to a proscenium arch with all kinds of deus ex machina. See, I didn't go to Yale for nothing. Stage devices and sets and all kinds of enhancements. And you only have a small amount of time. So where Johnny Mathis, who I like very much personally, over the years I've bumped into him now and again. He used to love his music an awful lot. He's very talented. He goes on, he tells a story about his dog, and everyone laughs. Well, a comedian has to go on with different standards. More is expected. So you must go on with the technique. And I sometimes don't do a stand-up. I've been established there for a long time, so they don't have to do one every time. But Rodney talked me into doing them more often, and he's right. Grab that time. But when you sit down on the panel, the best thing to do, you don't depend on some little subject you've discussed with a pre-interviewer, and Johnny will talk. Get some stuff ready. Do some stand-up sitting down. Be impactful. Get those laughs. And your job as an actor is to make those little conversational things look like little conversational things when they're really prepared ideas. So there is a couch technique, particularly for comedians who have the toughest go on any of those shows because they are the people right there. The talk shows do not sweeten laughter. If you don't get the laughs, it's quite obvious to everyone that you don't. The hardest ever was in that area was the Ed Sullivan Show, which I did do 6 times. In addition to having to sidestep a bear act in the wings before the animals, you know, are fed, they eventually separated the animals and taped them. You'd go out in front of an audience that can barely see you. Cameramen and technicians are busy. Sullivan is talking to the producer, Bob Precht, in between acts while you're on. It's hard to get their attention. And comedians were known to do fair there. I got by pretty well in my 6 shots, but that was a real tough one. You are standing there. There's no chance to increase the sound of the laughter. As you know, the famous laugh machine, Woody Allen finally, and someone finally showed it, I think Woody, in one of his movies. In first working with that machine in my summer show in 1970, I was so against it. But they said, we have to do this episodically, like cinema. We've got to cut. We have a very complicated sketches and all this, and then we have the laugh machine come in. And I said, oh, I hated it. And when they bring this expert in from California, the machine flies first class with him, strapped to a seat. It's an old typewriter case. It was a brilliant invention that no one else could duplicate. It was locked, padlocked, and no one knew how to operate it or how to build it but him and his assistant. And don't you think I became a pig? I'm putting laughter to some of our sketches and some of my jokes. Give it a 10. What, are you kidding?
I really hate laugh machines when I'm watching television.
Yeah, but you, believe me, even as a media person, may I say that at least some of the time you can be fooled. And the definitive research on this particular subject was done by your patron, public television, which really did discover that when you're watching something comedic and if there's pure silence, unless it's a film or something like that, it really hurts. And so it's seeking that happy medium. There are ways of doing things live, and I've subsequently done it, much of it live, and maybe a little business of sweetening. When you're on one of those talk shows and you're standing there, there's no chance for that. You're standing there and the test is made. And most of these shows, even the best of the sitcoms, if they have to redo something at 9 at night and the audience is gone already, they will sweeten it. And you'll never know.
What do you think of that portion in the couch shows and the talk shows like that where the next guest walks out and has to kiss everybody? Or you walk out and there's already 2 people on the couch and you have to lean over and kiss them?
It's entirely too much kissing. I mean, as a matter of fact, I have a bit about that. Did you know that?
No.
I have a piece about that, which I often do. I say there's much too much kissy-poo on television. We don't know each other. Everybody in show business doesn't know everyone else. Does every plumber know everyone else? Does every major general know every... and yet there's all this, like, how are you, darling? Who are you? Why are you kissing me? And being a liberated man, which I think, Terry, you can tell is true. I mean, it's quite obvious. Liberal is all over, liberated is all over, written all over my face. Ask my wife. Lauren Hutton, who is a beautiful model, an actress, was on. I put out my hand to shake her hand. I had met her a couple of times at New York parties. She told me she really admired my work. I told her I'm glad that she has a space between her teeth since I just spent $1,500 to close mine, you know. I put out my hand to shake her hand. Just my luck. Who gave me a tremendous soul kiss? Dr. Joyce Brothers. I mean, really, Terry. And Bobby, baby, you know, Joyce, what are you doing? And she's very hip, though. We had the dream sequence. What do you do when Joyce Brothers is on? Next, Dr. Brothers analyzes dreams. Gene Hackman told his dream. It was a Merv show or something. Lauren Hutton told her dream. And I told the recurring dream I've had for 15 years of hot dogs chasing donuts through the Lincoln Tunnel. And Dr. Joyce Brothers, who cannot be fooled and is pretty hip, told me I was hungry. That's sort of the routine. I don't like it. I think a lot of it is false. But you know something? Even though I'm in a certain... in that Night of 100 Stars, for example, in fact, I think the television version, which is only about half the six-hour show, is showing Sunday night, I think. People like Joan Collins, whose work I've never seen. I've never seen Dynasty, whichever one she's on. She's sort of inching to the front to get the best picture for the finale with some little Asian makeup man following her around her every move and all that. And here I am with a couple of other sensible people in show business, probably not as sensible show business-wise, who are being more modest, and if they get our picture, right, fine. It's still a wonderful, certainly for me, way of making a living, a great profession. and by and large, no worse than others. Excesses and drugs and alcoholism and divorce, I'm not sure would really exceed the rates of other professions. I think there's a lot of people who, from a Meryl Streep to who I think of, for example, lives unconventionally for a movie star, a little bit in upstate New York, has a family, cares about her family. I mean, Blythe Danner, who's a wonderful actress, she has to lug kids back and forth and here, and I know what that's like. And they're calm and intelligent about their art, their craft, and their fame. They're not overwhelmed with themselves, with people who get very important with entourages and all that. I mean, where do they feel they come off? If they do, fine. Will they still be here in 10 years is one question. And the other, who cares? The biggest star in the world, show me. And so what did they do? They made a great movie and they moved people and all that. I mean, Laurence Olivier is a wonderful, wonderful lifetime talent and craftsman. Great respect from everyone who was there. That's wonderful. De Niro, you know, I recalled with him that I did an interview with him many years ago. A little talk. I mean, he can evidently, you know, can talk with someone about something normally. He doesn't have to hide behind 40,000 people. And there are a lot more people like that in show business than ever before. Sensible people, I think.
Do you ever have performance nightmares anymore? Do you ever wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat because of a dream about performing?
It's funny you mention it, Doc. funny you mention it, Terry. Recently, when I was in Nice, attending my wife's rehearsals every day and generally just reading and playing with my baby, and well, lovely, it's 50 degrees and no tourists, and just along the Mediterranean. Two or three of the nights, I had disquieting dreams about show business. They were not nightmares as such, but I do remember waking up from one. I was rather glad I woke up and then went right back to sleep. And one of them involved Peter Boyle, my old... We met each other at the Second City reunion in 1968, and then he was a regular on my summer show in 1970 as an unknown, as was Madeline Kahn, my old friend. And it was like we were backstage at Second City about to do a bunch of sketches we weren't familiar with, as we did at the anniversary show recently, the 25th anniversary. And I remember saying to him distinctly, is the running order on stage left on the wall? He said, yes, you know. I was real nervous about going on and doing something with which I was unfamiliar. Don't know why I had that then, but yes, I sometimes do. And yes, there is, even though I have supreme confidence in my ability as a stand-up comedian and as an actor, I just did a movie of the week, which will be airing on March 18th, a romantic comedy called This Wife for Hire, with Pam Dauber and Lorraine Newman is in it and Tim Kazurinsky. I have total confidence in myself. When I go out there in one to perform by myself, I cannot mail it in. I really can't. That's a hard job any way you look at it. And I think that after doing it a lot, I definitely need rest. And then when I come back from those rests, I am so fertile and so raring to go. After France, I came back and did a concert at Queen's College in a series, their subscription series, that was just so innovative. And then after the movie, after a month doing a movie, I came back, I was exhausted, I hadn't had any sleep practically because I had it was scheduled right after it, and it was great because I had been away from it for a while. So there is a strain.
Do you listen to much comedy yourself? Go to clubs, listen to records?
Not as much as you'd expect. And I wonder if some of it isn't insecurity or envy or whatever. I am, certainly as regards my own work, monologue, I'm really a loner, a creative loner. I write every utterance, and I despise people stealing it or stealing anyone else's. I loved watching. The only thing I watched with some regularity that I really enjoyed watching very much was SCTV. It was the finest episodic comedy on television. Figures they had been affiliated with Second City. It had rhyme and reason. Monty Python. Like to watch very much. There's some very funny things on HBO, something called Not Necessarily the News. Sometimes they're very funny. I've really been enjoying Woody Allen lately. I saw several things for the second and third, fourth time in a hotel room in California, my off hours from the movie. I saw Zelig for the third and fourth time and liked it better the third time. It's funny, more than the first time I'd seen it. I haven't seen the newest one. It's such growth. It's a wonderful chance taking and all that. I gave up on Saturday Night Live a long time ago. I mean, I just feel it's kind of, I have to say, a little youngish and not really that well thought out.
Well, before we have to end, there's a joke I really wanted to tell you that I thought maybe you could use for one of your routines. Only kidding. Do you think, we only have a few seconds left, I know, but do you like the whole comedy renaissance that's been happening?
Yes, I do. I think that, I wouldn't say I started something or we started something. When I followed other people who took the lead, but it's a tremendously in thing now. And where the improvisation was the only club I knew of its kind when I started, there are now comedy clubs even in small and medium-sized cities. So it's all over the place. College contests, I like it, yeah.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you. And support National Public Radio.